WHUR-FM and HD1 Washington. Welcome to our special three-part daily drum series. Tonight, no justice, no peace. Here's Harold Fisher.
Justice looks like in black and white. An examination of issues that have come into focus since the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Tonight, the focus is no justice, no peace. What are the demands? How are they achieved? This is being heard on WHUR-FM, WHUT-TV, and all WHUR social media platforms. No phone calls tonight, but you can comment and ask questions on our social media platforms. My guests tonight are activist and attorney Dr. Malik Zulu Shabazz, Andre Watkins, activist and creative freedom fighter, and Michael Griffin, electoral organizer with Community Change. Let's start with Andre Watkins. Andre, thanks for joining the program. I appreciate it.
No problem, Harold. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Young person that you are, activist that you are, talk to me about your experiences. You've been really out in it protesting.
Yeah, I have been out. I've been going out since this past Saturday. My first protest or direct action that I participated in was with the Black Lives Matter DC chapter, run by leaders April Goggins, Nene Tay, and Makia Green. They hosted a car caravan, a moving protest. So basically, protesters came out, got in their cars, and drove to a location, protested, you know, throughout the city in their cars. Because one of the biggest things that BLM is trying to ensure is that we are keeping ourselves safe, considering COVID-19 and considering the impact of COVID-19 on marginalized communities, those being Black and brown people. They wanted to make sure that we remain safe. We practice social distancing. So we rode around the city protesting in our cars. And then when we got to a location, we made sure that we were practicing social distancing, very family oriented, joy-filled and liberating direct action. I've also been out to the Capitol. Most recently, I actually just came back this afternoon out with Freedom Fighters DC, an organization based in DC, fighting for the freedom of Black folk. And that action, we actually went out to the Capitol, and that one was a bit more intense. We went out and laid on our face for nine minutes, about the amount of time that George Floyd had me on his neck, painted our hands red to symbolize the blood on the hands that police officers who have committed police brutality hold on their hands. Moment of silence for George Floyd. And it was really, really intense, really emotional. So there's been different, you know, just different levels of emotion that I've experienced. But I think, you know, if I have time to just mention this, the most impactful direct action that I participated in, and not only today, well, I had actually gone out after curfew in DC. It was around 12 a.m. I saw some things happening on CNN, just decided to run out there with my fiance, jumped out, went out to headed toward the White House. And as I was out there, I'm a videographer as well as, you know, as a beat maker. And so I wanted to capture some video of just the things that were happening, of, you know, some of the things that were destroyed on behalf of like this movement. And so I was capturing footage, and a police officer in a car had approached me and a few other protesters, and it told us we needed to leave. It's past curfew. We didn't leave. We stick around. And so I would imagine that this officer got on the radio and called his fellow police officers, because what ended up happening is seconds later, after he gave us our couple of warnings, six officers drove past, and all you saw was fog. I didn't know what the fog was. I thought something was burning. And my fiance says, wait, that's not fog, that's not burning, or smoke, that's pepper spray. Suddenly, you get here, your eyes are burning, my face is burning. And so that was my first moment ever experiencing that. It was painful, didn't feel good, and definitely felt unsafe.
I want to drill down a little bit more on that, but I want to go to some of the latest news that everyone has been hearing today. I want to talk to Mike Griffin. Mike Griffin is now part of the conversation from Minneapolis. Mike, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. I want to talk to you about your reaction to the announcement today by Minnesota's Attorney General Keith Ellison that there was an upgrade or an amendment to the charges for Derek Chauvin and the other three former officers who have now been charged with aiding and abetting to second-degree murder.
Well, first off, can you hear me? Am I good?
Yes, you're fine. Go right ahead, please.
Okay. All right. So I was just down at Cup Foods. Sorry for being a little bit late, but there's a lot of traffic out there. I think the feeling is it's about time. It's about time for us to actually get what we deserve, and that's justice for George. A step in the right direction. I think it is for these folks to be walking around in the city for 8-9 days after choking out George for 8.5 minutes on camera. It's exactly part of the systemic problems we're facing in this country. We want justice for George, so we got to charge these cops. They're going to go through a trial, and hopefully they go to jail. There's a whole path to get there. But right now, what I'm saying is that the structure in this country is messed up. And in 3 months, in 6 months, in a year, we're going to be at the same very spot. So congratulations. Thank you for charging these cops. Everybody else in the world who kills somebody on camera for 8.5 minutes is going to go to jail very quickly. So great. They've gotten charged. Now the next step is to make sure this doesn't happen again and this stop happening in America. And what does that look like? That is a conversation I want to start having. I'm 34 years old. I remember the Rodney King riots. I was 5, right? So the amount of time, like, what has changed in this country? I got a 7-year-old nephew now. It's great to get justice for George, but what I'm fighting for is to make sure that my 7-year-old nephew don't come and be 34 years old having riots in his city because we have not done anything in America to actually change the structure of police accountability in this country.
Talk to me a little bit about the mood in Minneapolis. If you could ascribe a emotion to a city right now, what would it be?
We're pissed off. We are pissed off, and this is my media, right? So I can say this here and speak freely. Black folks in this city are pissed, and the reason why is that we have been beating a drum in this city and state for years. This is not the first murder of a black guy. Five years ago, Jamar Clark, a lot of brothers saying he was handcuffed. Google this, Jamar Clark, 6 years ago, killed by police. A lot of people said he was handcuffed. We waited 6-7 months for them to release a video camera. They released a dash camera. They didn't end up charging the cops. A year later, Philando Castile, killed with his daughter in the back seat of his car, stream live on Facebook for the world to see, right? And we have been beating a drum. And this goes to the city, this goes to the state. And then now we have this case of someone being murdered in broad daylight with teenagers videotaping him, begging him to stop, and this man crying for his mother. And our city and our county attorney gets on camera and says, you know what, hey, we need more evidence. Please come. If you have any more evidence of what happened before or after, please, I want to build this case. The fervor in the city was at a boiling point at that matter. And we focused our energy on that precinct. And for days, we had been going toe-to-toe with a lot of police aggression. As the sister just said before me, they aren't playing around. We're talking about giant military guns on streets with laser points. And anybody that's leading the chant gets a laser pointed towards them as if we're in a war, right? Canisters of tear gas being shot, that's illegal in times of war, being shot out into the, it hit a Somali girl across her, bust her head open, bleeding from the head, nowhere to go. A black guy races her off. Like, it was real out there. And so when I say our anger was at that precinct and the images that y'all saw in America, was the frustration in this city that has been building up over generations. And that was, and his death was the final straw. And that image of the police, of the burning, was an image of white supremacy that we wanted on fire. It was a release.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I was there, I might have handed them my lighter. It was watching that. There were fireworks. There was Beyonce in the streets. they were at, for once we were happy. It was a black utopia with a burning precinct. It was beautiful. It felt like Black Independence Day. They had fireworks going, their precinct burning, Beyonce was playing, and people were doing the electric slide. And they're handing out beer.
All right, let me ask you, because we have seen protests in big cities, small cities, towns, even today, there was a really muscular protest in Harford County, north of Baltimore County, dozens and dozens of people. When you were protesting, were you angry? Were you encouraged? What was your feeling while you were there? I'm asking Andre, the young sister who's there, because I want to kind of compare and contrast, you know, the various and sundry places. Okay. Andre, please go right ahead.
So obviously emotion filled, anger, sadness, feelings of, you know, somber feelings. But honestly, just feeling that it is my duty. It's my duty to be out there. I work with young people, and I have worked with young people as an educator over, it's been about a decade. I have a young niece, you know, as my brother spoke before me, you know, just having young people in your life, going out there and fighting so that they don't have to is important, is very important to me. It is my duty to go out there in those streets and to do what I can to show up and to move forward this movement for Black lives. I feel like it's a part of my legacy. I would never want to get to the point where I have my little niece who is a year old learning about COVID-19 and George Floyd and to ask me, well, what were you doing? And I'm like, oh, well, I was in my house and, you know, there wasn't really much that I could do. COVID-19, the pandemic, absolutely not. No, I'm taking my little behind, my little surrounding behind out there. And I'm going to be in the forefront. I'm going to do what I can to make sure that I'm pushing this movement forward. And so being out there, I will say one thing that was extremely hard for me is seeing 6 and 7 year olds out there protesting. There were young girls. I've seen young girls and young men, young people out there protesting with their families, crying. I just had a goddaughter call me yesterday, crying, boo-hooing, crying. I don't want anyone to be heard. I don't want these white people to harm these Black people anymore. I don't want these people to harm these protesters. I do this so that the people that look up to me, the young people that I work with every single day, my little niece and anyone else that's a young person does not have to take on this fight later on. This is why I do it. And that's exactly my mindset when I'm out there.
You know, Mike, here's something that I've been thinking about over the past couple of days. For a lot of young people who came well after the civil rights movement, whenever we've seen police brutality or any example of racism, just black and white, bold letter racism, you have people who are marching. And a lot of young people say, it's time to stop marching and do something. But this is different because the marching isn't just March on Washington and speeches. To be quite honest, there aren't a whole lot of well-known names speaking. These are grassroots community, neighborhood, next door people who are pissed off. Talk to me a little bit about why this is different, because it's also happening around the world.
So I've been to hundreds of protests in this country, dozens of Black Lives Matter protests. I would say in the past week, this is the most organic, young. These folks are, they're. I'm 34. These are 18, 19, 20, 20, 23 year olds. And I did the Obama. I'm the Obama generation. I started with Obama. They're smarter. They're better. They're more innovative. How I knew where to go was they were streaming it live on Facebook. And then the police tried to like zap their power. So then they just had their friends go out and get their more battery power. So they had batteries on batteries on batteries. So everybody knew where to go. So it was very organic. This was not a black pastor or an organization saying, hey, we're going to do this there and this is the speeches and we're going to do that. No, these are young people organically standing up around this city and state, and other people are following them. And I'm telling you, they're more innovative, they're smarter, they're hungrier, and there are, I feel like we're going to be in good hands because these folks aren't messing around and they're not going to take no for an answer. They're going to demand justice and demand equality. And I'm honored to be in their space, to be honest with you.
I want to talk about that in a bit also, but I want to remind our listeners and viewers that this is the first of a three-part series tonight, Thursday night, and Friday. No justice, no peace. What are the demands and how are they achieved? That's what we're focusing on tonight. This entire series is justice in black and white as we examine the issues that have come into focus since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. I want to introduce my new guest to the program, activist and attorney, Dr. Malik Zulu Shabazz, also previously joining us, Henri Watkins, activist and creative freedom fighter, and of course, Michael Griffin, electoral organizer with Community Change. He is coming to us from Minneapolis. Dr. Shabazz, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
It's my honor, Brother Harold, and to the great activists, you all are warming me up.
Thank you so much. Well, we need to get warmed up and continue to stay hot on this issue. Talk to me a little bit about the legality of what happened today. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison announcing the amending of the charges for Derek Chauvin and the other three officers. Simple question, why did it take so long? Everyone wants to know.
It took this amount of time because they were not gonna do this at all. They were not going to charge Chauvin with second degree murder, probably not even third degree murder. I have to be honest with you. If what happened in Minnesota, I have to be straight honest. If that police precinct did not burn down,
you better preach, brother.
We wouldn't be at this moment.
You better preach.
If that courthouse,
you better preach.
In Nashville didn't burn down, we wouldn't even be thinking about this moment.
Come on, Howard.
Keith Ellison would not be pressing the case. This has turned my brother, Mr. Harold, and you all into a matter of national security. And therefore, they don't mind giving Derek Chauvin a charge which would give him perhaps 40 years versus 25 years in order to save the country. When Donald Trump went out and attacked those teenagers, some of whom I'm likely to represent, and I've been out there as a legal monitor at that White House. Andre, I was out there because of you all. Because of your spirit and the spirit you all have put in the country, it's not a riot. The Declaration of Independence say it is a rebellion. And if it wasn't the Boston Tea Party riot, then this is the George Floyd rebellion right here. Now, what I'm saying is that this is driving the legal action. The activists, the street, and the organizers are forcing Donald Trump and forcing the attorney generals and forcing the governors to go back and to try to give us tokens of justice. And all we have to do now is not be satisfied with the tokens. None of us as lawyers and even prosecutors or anyone can work outside of the will of the people. I guarantee you, if this would have been a few statements from the normal, traditional, controlled black leaders and that was it, trust me, this guy would be charged maybe with manslaughter, or maybe say we're gonna wait some weeks, and the other three officers, Towle, Lane, and Coon, wouldn't have been charged. So we have to say thank you to the people and all power to the people.
I wanna talk a little bit about some of the legal pieces here, because one of the things that I just find fascinating, yes, I understand that police officers, when it comes to arresting them, charging them, prosecuting them, that historically there's been what some may say is a higher standard. But I guess the thing that is so troubling is when the Hennepin County District Attorney said, we need more evidence. And then almost miraculously, the other video showed that there are two more officers kneeling on George Floyd, preventing him not just from breathing, but from moving. And that is the thing that I find so disconcerting. Some people say this has happened quickly. Yes, compared to other officers, it may have. But this is not fake news. We've seen this. Talk to me a little bit, Brother Shabazz, about why, from a legal perspective, the aiding and abetting is so significant for the two officers who are kneeling on George Floyd and the other officer who was trying to block the view of the people who were videotaping.
It's significant here because normally police officers are not charged when they are on the scene and they could do something and they don't do it, or when they assist in these actions. Just normally they're not charged, so it's significant. Now the state says that the manner of death is homicide, but that is autopsy is cardiopulmonary arrest, complicating law enforcement subdual restraint and neck compression, that they put so much pressure on his neck that he had a heart attack. And then there was an independent autopsy that's done by the attorneys that say it was mechanical asphyxiation. It is the, either way you slice it, it is the officer's knee for those 8 minutes and 40 seconds on his neck, combined with all of the other officers on him at the same time, on Floyd, at the same time with all of that pressure on his body. Now I understand that he may have had some underlying medical conditions, what I'm reading. And this is why you don't do that. This is why the Constitution says you only use enough force that is reasonably necessary, or otherwise you've crossed over to excessive force on the civil level, or you've crossed over into the criminal level now. Chauvin is charged with second degree murder now, the intentional killing of another without premeditation. Most people who watch it say that was premeditated. The fact that everyone is being held accountable here is significant and it is unprecedented. And I think the struggle right now is for justice here and for every officer in this case. But what you're seeing around this country is a desire for a systematic change. The verdict is still out on whether that systematic change will occur, and we must keep driving for it right now. I mean, but there are significant, unprecedented legal developments that are occurring in this hour. Normally, they don't go after police officers this hard.
Yeah, yeah, and maybe it's because of the graphic nature of that video. I would argue, yeah, we see it in the movies, but when we see it in real life, it is real life.
Remember this now, he's
handcuffed. Real death in real life video.
And so you can imagine how many times this has occurred. And when they've written those reports up and said something different, how many brothers have died in the streets and false reports and no video was there? And now what you're dealing with here is a situation where the public is just not satisfied with what it used to be satisfied with. The public is not satisfied with what it used to be satisfied with. And the question is, can a systematic change be brought about? See, these brothers and sisters, and even other people, I've seen them out there of all ages. This is pain is deep.
Yes, it is.
And not going to be absolved just because Chauvin is charged.
Let me go back to Mike on that particular point. Mike, it's my understanding there's only been one conviction of a of a police officer.
Of a black man. A black man. Yes. A black man who killed a white woman is the only one who's ever been charged.
Who shot a white woman. How confident are you that the wheels of justice will be straight and narrow and right in this?
Okay. Over
here. So I'm not sure if he's going to be convicted. I think the evidence is overwhelming in this case, and it's moving in that direction. But to Brother Shabazz's point is this, we need to get to, so we're going to get justice for George, probably likely, maybe. But what are we doing for the systematic changes? For example, we just talked about how the police report was wrong. Somebody lied on the police report. Somebody approved that police report, and somebody signed off on that police report. The medical examiner did not have the same information that the police report had. Why is that? Who approved that? Why is it that every other case that we've ever had in Minnesota, the prosecutor would say there's not enough evidence to charge? And before we burned down the precinct, as Dr. Shabazz just said, he was still saying, oh, we were going to have an investigation for days, if not weeks and weeks and weeks. So the structure in itself has not changed at all for me to be convinced that I'm not next, or my brother's not next, or my nephew's not next 20 years from now. So I'm going to still be in these streets, right? And I think that let's get justice for George, yes, but let's not get distracted on this hamster wheel. A black guy gets killed, we go in the street, we get distracted, another black guy gets killed. And we just going on back and let's keep this going and let's keep it going. Let's not. Let's get off this cycle and have a difficult conversation with white people who need to have a difficult conversation with themselves about how we can change the structures of the system. Another example, there were cops that arrested a black CNN reporter live on TV.
Yes.
Those cops are still working, right? So as much as the governor of Minnesota wants to get up there and say Black Lives Matter, he went to Cup Food today and wrote something on justice, whatever, on the ground. He can do all that Minnesota nice stuff that he wants. But technically, when he gets down to it, he has the power to decide if these officers that arrested that black CNN reporter, who identified himself as a reporter, but still was arrested, if they had jobs. Those cops in New York City that rolled over that group of people, I'm sure they're still working. Why? Because we have not fixed the structure of what's happening in this country. And so to answer your question, a long way of saying, I would hope that, like, I can't be a one-man protest, but I would hope that we would still be out there in these streets making sure that we're organized, ultimately voting and protesting as well.
You are listening and watching part one of a special three-part series on the Daily Drum. This is what justice looks like in black and white. It is an examination of issues that have come into focus since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. I want to follow up on that one point, because when you were talking about the arrest of the reporter, one of the things that I think goes to your point that a lot of people miss, when the reporter said, "Why are you arresting me?" the response from the state police officer was, "I'm just following orders." And so this isn't about the people who arrested him. This is about the people who gave him the orders.